And that you didn't understand, please see me about it. I'll be available next week, Tuesday and Wednesday. And I'll be glad to see anybody next week, Tuesday or Wednesday, to discuss anything about the test. Now, we were speaking yesterday. Well, first, if I have all these papers, I want to just say a word about this. What I meant to bring out yesterday was that the hardest job in translation is not finding what the original means. That is a difficult task and may take a great deal of study. But there are many things one can, who knows even a little about a language, can easily determine about its meaning that are extremely hard to express in another language. And the poorest translator may hit on a way of translating a particular phrase or a particular sentence that exactly gets the idea in his own language. And consequently, the great advantage the King James translation had was that the committee that formed it had before them a large number of translations made during the previous 80 years by people who had tried to express the idea of the Greek and Hebrew in English. And these people had tried different methods of getting the idea into English. And the King James Version could find one very poor translation, but here and there a place where they had exactly hit the way to get into English that other people might not have thought of. And then here's an excellent translation, which over and over had hit a good way of putting it into English, and they had the benefit of those. And that's what we need today. That's why I'm always glad to hear that anyone is making a new translation of the Bible. Because even if it's a very poor translation, if he tries hard, he may hit on a few places on an excellent way of putting the idea of the original into English, which might not occur to anybody else. And then eventually we can take the way people have rendered it in our language of today from different translations and can get one translation that may be as good for our day as King James Version was for it. So that was a mighty high level to aim at. You got a question, Mr. Eisenstein?
Yes, then do you recommend for personal study or for your library one of these books where they ran 26 translations?
Yes, I would say that if you take a book that has a lot of translations together, or you take almost any translation, you look at the King James Version, and there are some translations that are definitely wrong. And there are a number of them which should have been different, but you can make an argument for them the way they are. On the whole, it's as good a translation as has ever been made into any language. Therefore, if you're going to depend on an English translation, I would say the King James is still the best we have. But I would say that any translation that anybody has made, you read it and you get an idea altogether different from what you found in the King James. Well, now maybe that idea was in the original, maybe it wasn't. But once you have the idea suggested to you, you can look at your Greek and Hebrew and check and see whether it is a good translation or isn't. So I would not put trust in any other translation that has yet appeared. But I would say any of them are useful to suggest ideas to check to see whether they're in the original. Because you look at a certain phrase in the original, and you're used to the King James rendering, which may be an excellent rendering of it. But you cannot exactly translate anything from one language to another. And it may be that in this statement in the original, there is a very definite, clear idea which isn't in the King James translation, which the translators may have been aware of, but they couldn't get it into English and also get the other idea that's in it that they thought was the most important in it. Well, you get that idea suggested to you somewhere else, don't take their word for it. Look at the Greek or Hebrew and see if it's there. And you may find it is there, and you may decide it's more important than the particular meaning out of the verse that the King James Version took. Now, I don't say that'll happen every case, by any means, maybe one time in five. You'll find it a tremendous help. Four times of five. Out of five, maybe a glance at the original will show you that actually it hasn't been well translated. So any other version is useful for suggestion. But the only thing you can trust is your Greek and Hebrew. And the King James comes nearer to it than any that's yet been made, with the disadvantage that it's in the language of 300 years ago, which nobody can talk today. And so there are many phrases in the King James that nobody today knows what they mean, unless they spent years studying the works of Shakespeare and other Elizabethan writers and so on. So that's the problem with the King James. Yes?
Has anyone ever gone to the trouble of taking a kind of a comparative dictionary and giving the words of that time and giving explanation to the meaning of words?
The best that I know of is a dictionary we have in the library called the New English Dictionary. The second edition of it was called the Oxford English Dictionary. And that's about 24 great big volumes. And they take each word and they give you citations from literature showing how it was used in different phrases. For instance, they take the word nice and they show you that about 1400 nice meant foolish or silly. And that about 1600, the word nice meant fussy, constantly making a lot about little trifles. And it's only within the last 100 years that nice has come to mean pleasant. And you look in the King James Version, you'll never find the word nice used anywhere in the King James Version. Because that word has gone through all these changes of meaning. Now that Oxford Dictionary is the best thing I know of on that line. But it doesn't do what you spoke of, specifically take that time, and ours in comparison, but it takes English words and tries to trace them through. And it's very helpful. I have a condensation of it in my office, which I use constantly. Yeah. Well, now the other question yesterday that was, we need a little more time on, was at the very end of the hour. I was speaking about the value of version. And I mentioned a case in connection with Acts 15. And as I started to mention that, I perhaps did not realize quite how long it might take to make that particular one clear, because it is a very important passage, and there are some very important elements that enter into it. Perhaps I should have taken a simpler illustration for the purpose of this class. But it is an illustration which is an excellent one of the question, to how great an extent can you use a version such as the Septuagint to correct the Hebrew? And the answer is that the Hebrew has been marvelously well preserved. And the Septuagint, in copying and recopying, all kinds of errors have come in. So that, in general, the Hebrew is far better preserved than is the Septuagint. And yet, there are places where the Septuagint has been, gives you a clue to the original. And those places are most apt to be either cases where the pronunciation of a word in passing it on orally, because the vowel signs weren't written down till about 900 AD, where the vowels became confused in passing it on orally. And consequently, using different vowels than we have in our present Hebrew Bible may give you the true original meaning. Now, there are not a tremendous number of cases like that, but there are a sizable number. So if you find that changing the vowels in a word may make a better sense, there's always the possibility that you're right, even though in general the vowel signs were preserved very well. The consonant signs being written were preserved better than the vowels, because they weren't even written down until about 900 AD, so they were passed on orally. But the other case where the Septuagint may give you a clue to the meaning is in cases where the letter daleth and the letter resh may become confused. I always try to have Hebrew students, there isn't a piece of chalk here, is there? If there was, I was going to illustrate that. Have you one? Thank you. Fine.
Thank you very much. I always teach in Hebrew, try to yes, always make the dollar point past here. And the Hebrew, the race round there, so you can always tell which is dollar, which is race, by looking at that corner. But in ancient times, they made the dollar like that, and they made the race like that. And you can easily see that whether it's the point or whether it's the curve, often is difficult to tell. And consequently, as I mentioned yesterday, there are many cases
where in Kings you have Adolphus in a proper name and you have a race in Chronicles or vice versa. In proper names, Dolus and Raish easily became confused because the two letters were more often confused than any other. Now, it's interesting that Hay and Jace to us look much more similar than Dolus and Raish, but Hay and Jace are very rarely, almost never confused in Hebrew manuscripts. But Dolus and Raish are. And consequently, there is always the possibility that there was either a Dolus or a Raish in the original Hebrew, and that in the course of copying, it the other one came to be substituted, that somebody misread the Dolus as a Raish or a Raish as a Dolus, and that that reading came to be the universally accepted reading. Now, that has not happened a great many times, but that is the second most likely possibility where the Septuagint might preserve for us the true meaning. Because in Greek, the letters corresponding to Dolus and Raish are not easily confused in writing. And more than that, there may be two entirely different words, one of which is written with a Dolus and one of which is written in Hebrew with a Raish. There may be two entirely different words. And a very good illustration of that is found in Acts 15. Because in Acts 15, after the apostles and the leaders of the church in Jerusalem had discussed an important matter at length and had given their opinions, the chairman of the meeting, James, the brother of the Lord, said, "This matter is decided by the fact that we find it already stated something of great relevance to it in the prophet." And then he quoted a passage from the book of Amos. And as he quoted this passage, it completely settled the matter. But the assembly had been divided. And some had held one view and some another. Now, suppose James had mistranslated the Hebrew. You can be quite sure those people there would have risen up in wrath and said, "That's entirely wrong. You're simply reading from a Greek mistranslation. The Hebrew says so and so." James quoted the Septuagint, the common Greek translation. But most of the people there, at least many of them, certainly knew the original Hebrew. And if the Septuagint had been wrong, they certainly would have said, "Look at here, you're doing this quite wrong. The Hebrew says so and so." So it would seem that situation there would seem to make it conclusively certain that in this particular passage where we have a race in the Bible as it stands today, at the time of the early church, there was a Dolus. And in the years since that, the Dolus has been copied as a race and has come to be in all our manuscripts as a race instead of as a Dolus. And so, as you express that in English or in Greek, that sounds like two entirely different things. You wonder how on earth the same verse could be read two utterly different ways. But it's easy to see when you look at them, that is simply the difference of a Dolus and a Raish. So in a case like that, where you have the Septuagint appearing at first sight to be utterly different than the Hebrew, I would say in most cases the Hebrew is to be preferred because the Hebrew has been copied with such remarkable care all through the ages. But if it is a difference of a Dolus and a Raish, there is some possibility that the Septuagint might preserve the original. And if you have, in a case like that, the New Testament quoting it, and not only quoting it in a general way, but quoting it in a meeting where there were people present who would have gumped up and said, "James, you're wrong, that isn't what the Hebrew says at all." If you have it in a case like that, where the whole point of the discussion hung on that word, you can be sure that the Septuagint there has preserved the true sense and that the Hebrew has become corrupted in that way. Now that is the situation regarding the quotation in Acts 15 from Amos 9. Yes?
Can I ask where Amos?
Yes. Amos 9. Yeah. Well, we'll take just a minute, though. This really is a matter of discussion of either exegesis of Amos, exegesis of Acts, or eschatology. But it is a case where it's such a good illustration of the point I've just brought out that I'll take a minute and look at the two passages. And here in Acts 15, well, first I'll read you what it says in the Amos passage. In Amos 9, at the end of the chapter, verse 11 following, you read, "In that day will I raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen." What does that mean, raise up the tabernacle of David that is fallen? Does that mean build the church? How has the church been fallen? And how is it the tabernacle of David? "The tabernacle of David that is fallen, and close up the breaches of it, and raise up its ruins, and I will build it as in the days of old." Now, there's no difficulty with this verse. This verse is in the Septuagint, very close to the Hebrew. But the next verse is where the problem comes. "That they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the nations which are called by my name, says the Lord who does this." Now, that second verse is the important one. So I'll read you what James said about that. James said, "To this agree the words of the prophets as is written, after this I will return and build again," and then continuing is the same practically as in Amos, till you get to the next verse, which says, "That the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the nations upon whom my name is called, says the Lord who does all these things." Well, you see how different it is. "That the rest of men might seek after the Lord," James quotes. And the Amos says that they may possess the remnant of Edom and of all the nations which are called by my name. Very, very different. Now, a question was raised yesterday about the fact that James starts with saying, "After these things I will return," and Amos starts saying, "In that day." And I think we should note that in the quotation, as very often when we make Bible quotations to deal with a point, we summarize the situation. And we don't necessarily quote the whole verse. We quote a portion of the verse, which is applicable with a summary introduction to show how we understand it. When Amos says, "In that day," in study of the prophets, you soon find that the phrase "in that day" is a common phrase in the prophets, not for one particular time, but saying there is going to be a time when. It is looking to the future, not specifying when, but saying there will be a time when. Now, James is giving his interpretation of what the time is, when this will happen. James says, "After this I will return at." In other words, he's saying Amos is predicting what will happen when the Lord returns. That's James' interpretation. It's an inspired interpretation. It's not a quotation from the Old Testament. There are commentaries, many of them, which say this quotation is taken from Amos 9 and from another passage together. It's a combined quotation. They find another passage. I meant to look and see what it was they say, but I don't recall at the instant. They find another passage where just find the words, "After this I will return at." And they say that must be quoted from another place in the Old Testament. I think that is a foolish way to deal with quotations from the Old Testament. The fact that you have two or three words, not important to the thing you're driving at, found somewhere other than the passage you're quoting, doesn't mean you're quoting that other passage. You quote a passage which stresses the thing you're trying to bring out. And the introductory words, even if somewhere else it says, after these things I'll return. That's not what James is building on. James is simply positioning the quotation to show where he thinks it's going to be fulfilled. "After this I will return and." He thinks here's a prediction regarding the return of Christ. "Now I will return and build up the tabernacle of David that's fallen and do these things." That's identical in the two. But then James quotes the Septuagint, which says that the remnant of men and all the Gentiles upon whom my name is called may earnestly seek me, says the Lord who does all these things. In Acts he says, "May seek the Lord." Now, "may seek me," says the Lord. As you see, he's not quoting exactly word for word there, but he certainly is quoting the exact idea. "May seek me," says the Lord, or may seek the Lord who does these things. It gives the exact idea of the original. But the difference is, one says that they may seek me, and the other says that they may possess the remnant of Edom. Well, the difference between seek and possess is a big difference in English. And it is an equally big difference in Greek. But the difference in Hebrew is only a difference of one letter. Now, of course, there's one other thing there's a difference in. One says they may possess the remnant of Edom. The other says that the remnant of mankind may seek the Lord. Well, the word Edom is Adom, and the word mankind is Adam. The consonants are identical, so that it is a matter of the vowels that go with the consonants, which could easily have become confused in the course of passing them on by word of mouth up till 900 A.D. So the difference between Edom and mankind is not a problem at all. But the difference between they may seek and they may, will possess is a difference of dalet and reish. One is the verb yarash, which means to possess. And the other is the verb to seek, which has a dalet instead of the reish, and it is practically identical. Otherwise, it is just a difference of one letter between the two, and it is here a case where the Septuagint has the difference, which at first sight appears very great, but on observing the difference, you find it's a dalet and a reish. And if you find such a difference, in most cases the Hebrew will be correct, but when you have the inspired statement in the Scripture that James, the leader in this council, used that as the primary verse in deciding this important theological matter, depending upon this particular statement, and there were people right there who would immediately have risen up and objected if it wasn't, you can be right sure that we have here what the Hebrew said at that time. And of course, the slight difference in copying could easily come in the course of the centuries since that time. I shouldn't say easily, because they copied very, very carefully. But these are the places where there are letters that are very similar. That is where such a difference can occur. Now we're speaking then of the value of the study of versions for text and for exegesis, and we notice these difficulties with them in fixing text. Now we want to speak briefly about B, what makes a particular version have special value. What makes a particular version have special value? And that which makes a particular version have special value is any one of two qualities. Any one of two qualities makes it have special value. And those are, the first of those is very obvious, the second not quite so obvious. The first is its age. Its age. Is it ancient? If somebody translates the Hebrew into English in 1971, that's not of much value in finding out what the Hebrew text was in 200 B.C. That's perfectly obvious. So if the Hebrew has been translated into Arabic in 1200 A.D., that doesn't tell us much about what the Hebrew was at the time of Christ. Is a version ancient? That is the first criterion. For the importance of a version, its age is of tremendous importance. Is it ancient? Or is it not? The other criterion is not quite so obvious, but is equally important. That is a version immediate? Is it immediate or mediate? And by that we mean, has it been translated direct from the Hebrew or from something else? If you make a translation out of English into some Indian language, that translation in that Indian language tells what you think the English means. It doesn't tell what you think the Hebrew means. You've gone through two steps. When I hear something that somebody has said or done so and so, I say, how do you know that? And if they say, well, so and so told me that they heard it from such and such. Well, I say with every additional step you go through, there is a great possibility of error coming in. Get back to the source before you trust any rumor. Well, it is equally true of translation. When a translation is made from a translation, you increase the distance, the difference from it. No translation is identical with the original. Now, if you take an English translation, which may be an excellent translation, that English translation is going to have some things in it which are different from the original. It can't help it, because you can't express it exactly in English. Then if you make a translation into another language, and you take those possible ideas of the English that weren't in the original, you translate them into the other language, you've got something that doesn't represent the original at all, as you can see. And so the question whether a translation is immediate or not is very important in determining its value. And the most important, the most useful translation would be a translation that is both ancient and immediate. Well, now there are four ancient and immediate translations of the Bible. That's not to say that translations that are ancient and immediate do not have some value. They do. But their value is in determining the text of the translation they're made from. And it, in turn, may be of value in determining the text of the original. So there are four ancient and immediate translations. These are, first, the Septuagint. That is to say, the ancient Greek translations of the Old Testament. Those are very ancient. They are made about 200 B.C., they are immediate, they are made from the Hebrew. They are of great value to us, though they have been terribly poorly copied and recopied. To get the exact text of the Septuagint is in many places very difficult because there are such variations among the manuscripts. But of course there are many things on which all the manuscripts agree. So it is of real value, the Septuagint. Now the second ancient and immediate translation is what we call the Targum. The Targums were translations into Aramaic. And I believe when I discussed the value of the Aramaic language with you some time ago, I mentioned how it is of importance, not only because a part of the Old Testament is in Aramaic, but also because we have very early translations of the Bible into Aramaic. And these early translations into Aramaic are of great importance for Bible study. And I was disappointed, I was glad to find that most of you remembered in your test that the Aramaic is used in part of the Old Testament, but there seemed a great many who forgot that it is also of value for ancient translations of the Bible into Aramaic. Now, there are two of these out of the ancient and immediate translations, two of them are in Aramaic. One of those we call a Targum. And Targum is an Aramaic word which means a translation. And it's called the Targum because after the Jews ceased to speak Hebrew, it became customary in the synagogue to read the Hebrew and then for someone orally to give a translation. And so these oral translations they called Targums. And as time went on, and the translation gradually changed as people improved it from time to time, and probably the man who for 40 years had always stood in the synagogue and given the translation of the Hebrew passages, he died and his son took his place. He had for 30 years heard his father giving the translation. The chances are he knew it by heart and he did it the same way his father did. Or he may have improved on it a little bit. But in the course of time, these Targums became crystallized. So that the Targum, which was oral, had a certain definite form, and then this form was written down. And the Targums were written down originally in Palestine, in the early Christian era, and then some copies of them were taken to Babylonia where they were changed somewhat by the Jews in Babylonia and then brought back to Palestine and became the standard Targum. There were other Targums which had grown up in Palestine in the meantime, which were not quite the standard. But these Targums sometimes don't merely translate, they explain. They will tell what they think it meant, and some of them have very long explanations of the meaning of the passages. These Targums were, some of them have been preserved through the ages and available to us. Quite a number of new ones have been found in the Cairo Geniza, and these are now being published. And these are ancient Aramaic translations of the Old Testament, which are of great interest to us to show what those Jews thought the Old Testament words meant, and sometimes to show what they thought the different statements in the Old Testament meant. Yes?
You speak of Texas, and you mean one Alexander?
Yeah, I will take up each of these individually and say a little about them. And we will say a little about that separately. But at this point, I've so far just been using the word Septuagint to mean ancient Greek translation. And then we will discuss, there are certain others too. We'll discuss them separately. It's an important question, but I mean, I'd rather take it up at that separate point. Then the other Aramaic translation that is ancient and immediate is into a dialect of Aramaic called Syriac. Syriac, S-Y-R-I-A-C, is a dialect of Aramaic, which came to be the most widely used dialect of Aramaic. It was the language of a kingdom, the kingdom of Edessa, north of Palestine. And the people in this kingdom became Christians quite early. And they began they translated the New Testament into Syriac, and also the Old Testament. Now the Targums, of course, are only the Old Testament. The Septuagint, of course, is only the Old Testament, because the New Testament is Greek already. But the Syriac is a translation of both the New Testament and the Old. And the New Testament translation into Syriac is probably older than the Old Testament translation into Syriac, which may have not been made until about 400 A.D. But the Syriac translation, which is called the Syriac Peshitta, the word Peshitta, P-E-S-H-I-T-T-O, sometimes you'll see it with a final A instead of a final O, P-E-S-H-I-T-T, either O or A. This was, the word means the common translation, Peshitta. It's a translation into Syriac. The New Testament made very early, the Old Testament a little later, probably between 400 and 500 A.D. And Syriac is of great value for study of early church history, much of which was written in Syriac. And the Syriac New Testament is of great value in for textual study of the New Testament. And the Syriac Old Testament is of considerable value, but it has been affected by the Septuagint. So that being later than the Septuagint and affected by the Septuagint, the translators of it doubtless were familiar with the Septuagint, it's not quite as primary as the Septuagint. And then there's one other ancient immediate translation, which I believe you all know what it is. You certainly should by this time, though you might not think of it. Another ancient language of great importance is the Latin language. And Christians soon began translating the New Testament and the Old Testament into Latin. And we call this the Old Latin. It was made by many different people at many different times. But at about 400 A.D., St. Jerome, a great Christian scholar, set to work to make a new translation into Latin, a translation into the common Latin, which they called the Vulgar Latin, the common Latin. He didn't mean a language of low type at all. It was the language Latin as spoken then, rather than as spoken 500 years earlier. And so they came to call this the Vulgate. And the Vulgate is the translation into Latin made by St. Jerome. We've already said a fair amount of it in other connections earlier. This is an ancient, immediate translation made by a great scholar who knew the Hebrew directly and the Greek directly, studied them carefully, spent a long time working on his translation, and it is, on the whole, an excellent translation. Unfortunately, the Vulgate has not been preserved as well as the Hebrew text has. There was a pope 400 years ago who said, The Vulgate is the correct Bible, not the way the Protestants do go back to the Hebrew and Greek. It's the Vulgate. It's the Latin that's the correct Bible. And up till very recently, any Roman Catholic translation had to be made from the Vulgate. Although good Roman Catholic scholars today, if they make a translation, make it from the Hebrew or Greek, but they say on the title page it's from the Vulgate, from the Latin, and then they may put in small note with consideration of the Hebrew and Greek. But if they're real good scholars, they make it from the Hebrew and Greek because they know that the Vulgate is a step removed from the original, from the Hebrew and Greek. But this Pope, about 400 years ago, said the Vulgate is the correct Bible. That's the one we should read. And then people pointed out to him that there were different manuscripts of the Vulgate that differed considerably because errors had come in the course of copy. And so he appointed a committee of scholars to make a new version of the Vulgate that would be the correct version, which he would infallibly declare is the correct Bible for everybody to use. But unfortunately for him, before he got ready to put his imprimatur on this new version, he died. And the Pope who succeeded him didn't like the version he'd had made, so he ordered all the copies of it destroyed and appointed a new committee to draw up a new version of the Vulgate to be the authoritative version. And I'm not sure they ever really did complete the work because there is considerable diversity in copies of the Vulgate. And yet, after you even mention that fact, the fact remains that we do have a fairly good approximation of the translation Jerome made in 400 AD, and it was an excellent translation. And so the Vulgate can be of great value for study of text, to know what the text was in 400 AD, and also for study of interpretation, to know what people at that time thought these Greek and Hebrew words mean. So we have these four ancient and immediate versions, which I've thus summarized. And then we'll mention C, the Greek versions. The Greek versions. And the Mr. Jones raised a very proper question. What do we mean by the Septuagint? So we'll make that number one under Greek versions, the Septuagint. And the Septuagint has been so much more widely distributed than any other Greek version, and is so much older than any other Greek version, that it deserves priority in this consideration. But there are other Greek versions. Now, the origin of the name Septuagint comes from an interesting fable. There is a letter written called the Letter of Aristeas, A-R-I-S-T-E-A-S. This has been preserved, this letter of Aristeas, in which Aristeas tells how the king of the second Ptolemy, Philadelphus, the second of the Ptolemies, ruling in Egypt somewhat before 200 B.C., about 250 maybe or a little earlier, Ptolemy Philadelphus was building a great library in Egypt, and he wanted to have copies of the sacred Jewish books. And so, according to the letter of Aristeas, he sent to Jerusalem and asked the high priest. Jerusalem, Palestine was then owned by Egypt. He wrote and asked the high priest to send him some fine scholars. And the high priest picked six out of each tribe, so that was 72 men. And so these 72 men came to Egypt. But he sent them on one condition, that after they complete their work, they should be sent back. And according to the letter, that was a wise condition, because when Ptolemy gave them a big dinner and asked them all kinds of questions, he found them such very wise men, he wanted to keep them to help him ruling his empire, but he'd given the promise to let them go back, so he couldn't keep them. But after giving great festivities to these men, he put these 70 men in 70 rooms, each one separate, for 70 days. And at the end of that, each of them had made a translation of the five books of Moses, and their translations agreed in every word. Now that's the fable. And that's written in this letter of Aristeas. It's generally considered as a fable somebody wrote 50 or 100 years later to try to explain the great excellence of the translation of the five books of Moses in Greek. Somebody in Alexandria made this translation. We don't know who. But it was a translation which was a very excellent translation. The five books of Moses are translated into Greek very, very excellently in what we now call the Septuagint. And that was doubtless the beginning of Greek translation of the Old Testament. Whether King Ptolemy had anything to do with it, we don't know. And we certainly don't believe 70 men worked on it 70 days and made 70 translations that were identical, word for word. We don't believe that. The Lord could cause that to happen, but we have no reason to believe he did. But this was done with the five books of Moses, and then other people made translations of other books. And as you know, the books were then in scrolls, so you couldn't get more than about, say, the book of Leviticus on a scroll. You couldn't get, you might get the whole Pentateuch on a scroll, but it would be too big and awkward to use well. And you certainly wouldn't get the whole Old Testament. So the other books were translated in the course of the next 100 years by different people at different times. And some of them are very excellent translations, and some of them are rather sloppy translations. So aside from the Pentateuch, there is great variety in the nature of the Septuagint translation. There's great variety. I was at an intervarsity camp, and there were some people there who were attending modernist colleges, and a girl from a college started as a Christian college, now thoroughly modernist, mentioned how in her class in Bible, which all the students were required to have in order to tear down their faith in the Bible, they were told that the idea of a virgin birth originates not with the New Testament, but with the Septuagint. And that was supposed to call it down. Actually, of course, Alma, they said in Isaiah, simply meant a young woman. And I pointed out to her that the fact that these Greek-speaking Jews at about 200 B.C. would translate that word Alma in the Hebrew as virgin at that time, before the virgin birth of Christ had ever been spoken of, is a mighty good proof that God had predicted the virgin birth that far ahead, and that's what the word Alma means. It's not an idea that originated with Christians that Isaiah 7 predicted a virgin birth. The Septuagint translators read it that way 200 years before the time of Christ. Behold, a virgin shall conceive. Yes? Yes, the Septuagint Pentateuch is a very excellent translation of rather uniform quality. That is, it's uniformly a good translation. Now, I don't mean it's a perfect translation. There are places where it does not quite get the idea naturally, as in any translation. But on the whole, it is recognized as an excellent translation. The other books of the Old Testament, some of them are excellently translated and some of them sloppily translated. There is great variety. And scholars are generally quite agreed that the rest of the Old Testament, what we call the Septuagint, was various translations made by various people during the years, say, between 250 and 150 B.C. And, of course, it was all put together into one volume at about 400 A.D., but these separate scrolls were circulating, and the term Septuagint, which originally applied only to the five books of Moses, came to be applied to the whole thing. So we speak of the Septuagint referring to the whole thing. Yes?
Is the Greek in which the Septuagint is put, is it uniformly Koine, or is it?
Yes. It's uniformly Koine. Yes. It's good Koine Greek, affected by Hebrew in some places, as these were Jews who did it, and they're translating from Hebrew. But it's uniformly Koine. It's the same Greek as the New Testament. Of course, there's much more of it, because it's a much larger book. Well, we'll have to continue there next week, Tuesday. As I mentioned yesterday, we do not...